This episode of Boss Level Podcast is sponsored by Lean Agile Scotland. If you want to go beyond the basics, this conference is for you. I thought it was very accurate when last year someone tweeted that Lean Agile Scotland is the conference for agile adults. Because it really is. Speakers include Dave Snowden, whom you've already heard on this podcast, Melissa Perry, whom you've already heard on this podcast, Catherine Kirk, whom you've already heard on this podcast, Jay Bloom, whom you will be hearing on this podcast. So the conference is going to be full of smart people having interesting discussions. To learn more and to get your ticket, go to leanagile.scot. That's leanagile, one word, .scot. When purchasing tickets, be sure to use the promo code BOSSLEVEL, one word, all caps, to get 10% off your ticket price. I'm definitely going to Lean Agile Scotland, so I hope to see you there. Welcome to another episode of Boss Level. Today's guest is Jay Bloom. A few years ago, he walked into the Carnegie Mellon University Library, approached the design section, and picked up a book starting with the letter A. His plan is to keep reading until he gets to Z. His definition of design is the intentional formation of a purposeful system. He says science has no intention towards the future, but design does. Jabe's brain couldn't contain all the wisdom he has, so it started growing out of his head in the form of a beard that now grows so fast it runs its own growth accelerator program for startups. Okay, this intro is probably getting a little out of hand, but my point is, Jabe's a smart guy and I've learned a lot from him. And I hope you will too. So enjoy the interview. At the end of the episode, I'm going to play another song from the new Embreach album, so don't rush off too soon.
So I'm Jabe Bloom. I have been a chief architect, a CTO for about 20 years. Right now, I am a consultant at a company called Praxis Flow. Praxis Flow is a company I founded with Kevin Baer, who co-authored the Phoenix Project, and Will Evans about 2 years ago. And we're interested in exploring how to take organizations beyond best practices and examining their organizations as holistic systems.
Okay, and what's like a normal engagement for Praxis Flow?
In particular, we're interested in applying design thinking to IT organizations, which means everything from, you know, doing work system designs, trying to think through how people work together, organizational design, all the way through to thinking about how to make people in IT more aware of their end users and what their end users are doing. So that might be service management, service design. And then really working with people like enterprise architects and things like this to change the way they think about the problems that they're engaging in. So that would be, you know, lean thinking, Kinevin, complexity thinking, things like that. And, you know, the way that we tend to engage is a series of workshops, lectures, trainings, active hands-on coaching. But we do what we call a whole stack. So we do everything from executive level coaching all the way down into team level coaching. And we try to get the organizations to really think about the fact that they need to engage in a holistic effort to change the way they think. They can't just change at one level. They really have to change holistically, all the way up their stack, all the way across their stack. And that's a challenge.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And actually, you're also going to be one of the first design PhDs in the U.S. So can you talk a little about that?
Sure. So it's actually quite common to have a PhD in design in Europe, especially what's called a practice-based PhD. And in the United States, it's significantly less common. In the U.S., the terminal degree for most designers is a master's. And CMU, about 4 years ago, decided that they were going to relaunch their PhD program They had an initial cohort of about six.
Just CMU, can you?
Like, yeah, sorry. Carnegie Mellon University decided to relaunch their PhD program. They had a cohort of about six PhDs under the previous head of school, Richard Buchanan. They've all graduated recently, and they just relaunched it. So I am in the newest cohort. I'm the in the first class, the newest cohort. So we'll be, our cohort will be one of the first new of the new group to get PhDs in the United States. You know, in the U.S., the value of a PhD is going to be interesting to see what it's worth. In Europe, you can get a PhD in design already, and a lot of a lot of institutions expect you to have a PhD in order to do research and teaching. In the United States, that's still not the case. So, be interesting to see how it kind of plays out.
I remember like talking to you like a year or two ago when you said that you read a lot, like in general, but like starting the PhD, you've started reading even more.
Yes. Yeah. So the first year of coursework was very intense. My college professor, Cameron Tonkinwise, was basically like, so, you know, there's really only 20 years of writing in design, so we should just start at the beginning and read all of it, which was a lot of fun and very interesting to really kind of settle yourself into a dialogue and be able to engage at that level. I think is interesting. I don't think everybody who's doing a PhD can actually grasp their entire field quite as well as we're going to be able to, simply because the field's not very big yet.
Yeah. So what do you think, like, what does a PhD in design prepare you for?
So, you know, a PhD in design is interesting. You know, PhDs in general are licenses or, you know, certificates to teach. That's the traditional way of thinking of them. And certainly some aspect of what we're doing is that, is making sure that you're capable of holding the breadth of the literature in your head and be able to explain it effectively to students and therefore be a good lecturer, good professor eventually. I think the reason I went back was I really... I wanted 4 years to think. I wanted 4 years to think about some of these issues. I think it is a interesting time to think about design. I think it's a very critical moment in design thinking. And so I was really excited to have the opportunity to spend about 4 years thinking. You know, where it'll get me to, I'm hoping to contribute to the way people think about design in the future, change the way people think about how to design things, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to think about. Like, I think most people struggle with finding 15 minutes every now and then to think, and you kind of took 4 years. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the first thing was making a commitment that I was going to actually... So, like anything, kind of like having a purpose behind something is useful. So, actually, the PhD gives me an excuse to prioritize that work. And it's not just reading. It's reading for my PhD. It's writing for my PhD. And so when I'm making decisions about taking a gig or, you know, how I'm going to work or how I'm going to structure my life, it right now involves I need to finish my PhD. So really giving yourself the ability to think through that, I think, is I think it's a very privileged thing, but I'm really excited to be able to do it.
In one of your conference presentations, you said that your definition of design is the intentional formation of a purposeful system.
Yep.
So what the hell does that mean?
All right. So I think, you know, one of the interesting things about design is how under-theorized it is to a certain extent. I think there's this weird way that people look at designers as being relatively theoretical. They think of them as kind of being... people are interested in thinking about things. But actually explaining what design is actually quite difficult. Differentiating it from, say, engineering or defending it from science as ways of thinking is difficult. Some people describe design as maybe the third way of thinking. So you might have the arts and you might have the sciences, and these are two different ways of thinking traditionally in the academy. And then maybe there's a third way of thinking, and that third way maybe is design. And so in this way, like, science is not really intentional. It's not about a futuring. It's not about desiring to change something. Now, there's certainly a practical application of science, which intends to do those types of things, change the future. But really, pure science, in the traditional sense, has no intention towards futures. It has intentions to understand presents, maybe even intentions to understand pasts or predict futures, but no intentions to change those things. Ideally, you know, science is completely objective. It doesn't have something in it that is intending. Arts, maybe there's some intentionality in there, so that kind of starts a little tangle with the arts and trying to get it disentangled from that. But the first step of design is that it is trying to change something in the future. It's active. It's an attempt to improve things. And so, you know, what are those things that we're trying to improve? I like to use this concept of systems. I say purposeful systems in a very explicit reference to Akoff's theories, and in particular a paper called Towards a System of Systems, where he tries to describe human-made objects are purposeful. They're, you know, in kind of philosophy speak, they're functional, they're instrumental, they're pragmatic, they're attempting to do something with a purpose. In kind of very low-level, kind of philosophical way, it's actually hard to think of making something without a purpose. It's hard to conceptualize that in many ways. You know, maybe you look at, like, Pollock's drip paintings or something like that and ask if he was being purposeful about that. I don't know. But anyway, so I think, you know, design is this intermingling of intending towards futures and making futures better by creating purposeful systems.
Like, what do you think are the existing design flaws in our organizations, and how can we go about fixing them?
Wow.
it's not a small question, I know.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things that come to the fore pretty quickly. One is just drift. So what I mean by drift is organizations tend to optimize towards some environmental goal that they're after. They adapt to some marketplace or they adapt to some environment. And because the overarching kind of mental model for organizations is efficiency, they over-adapt to those local variables. And then when those variables change, things go sideways pretty quickly. And so really that kind of efficiency-minded way of thinking becomes very problematic, I think, in a lot of modern organizations. The environment around them is changing quite quickly. The aspects of strategic play between organizations have figured out that they can break each other by intentionally changing environmental variables that their competitors are overly dependent on. And they modulate those variables intentionally in order to break each other's systems. And so the result of that is that you really need to start thinking differently about how you organize. And so, you know, so organized towards being able to change or organized towards being able to adapt more quickly, which means you have to sacrifice a certain level of efficiency. Now, I don't really want to suggest that you should look at the organization monolithically and say you shouldn't be efficient anywhere. I think that means starting to break the organization into pieces, conceptual pieces, and saying some of the organizations should be highly adaptive and some of the organizations should be kind of plastic and some of it should be relatively efficiency-based. And the efficiency-based plays are what pay for the highly adaptive-based plays, and the middle, kind of more plastic ones are the ones that kind of are the shock absorbers, if that makes any sense. So I don't know. Trying to think through those ways of changing the way that organizations kind of conceptualize how they live is a thing.
And I think there's also, like, there's a link from this to the kind of the business that you're in, because in certain businesses you need more adaptability and in certain businesses you need more efficiency, and you kind of, like, have to find the balance for your market. Yep. Because, like, I would say that if your business is more about being able to adapt, then the more self-organized and the more like general you can be, the easier it's going to be for you to adapt. Absolutely. And when you're like, when you're aiming for efficiency, then specialists and even hierarchies and silos are actually a really good thing, because you can focus very heavily on the things that you need to do.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, and so design is modulating those variables. That's what we, you know, that's what I think design literally means, is understanding what are the knobs we have to turn, and what settings should we set them at, right? The problem ends up being when you forget that they're just knobs, right? And that you can actually change them. When you set them there and you forget that they're set there and go off and do something else, and then you come back and you say, well, we've always been organized into a hierarchy, right? So that gets us back to that first part of the conversation, which is, you know, you have to be able to think differently. You have to be able to think differently in different situations. And in most orgs, it's going to be that some of the people are going to be organized in one way and thinking in one way, and some of the people are going to need to be organized in a different way.
Yeah. And I think one of the problems with that also comes from the fact that, like, maybe in the beginning or like at some point in the company's history, we understood that there are these knobs and we kind of made a choice. Yep. And then like years go by and we never like recheck them. We don't check like what, like, are we still like, yep, is the market still similar? Do we need to like turn the knobs at this, yep, moment now, yep, and, yep, find another solution?
Yeah. Yep. And I think, you know, highly successful organizations actually have that problem in spades, because what ends up happening is they insulate themselves from the market by being successful. They actually can absorb significant market turbulence by having a pad of profitability. And then when that pad comes down too close, they can't figure out, well, where did we go wrong? And it's because they don't remember having those shocks. They've insulated themselves from the shocks. And so, you know, Shine has, I think, an excellent way of kind of explaining his way through this, which is roughly like, you know, most organizations, they got a founder, some guy who had some really good ideas. The reason you know he had really good ideas is because the organization
exists
and doesn't not exist. Yeah. And so, you know, there's some cohort that is with him originally, and they might understand a lot of his decisions, or maybe all of his decisions, or maybe none of his decisions. But that initial cohort is not very large, because all companies start small. And as the organization grows, the way the founder thinks gets propagated without the way the founder makes decisions, which is different, right? Why did we choose this? Why did we choose to think like this? Why did we choose this in this moment? Things like that. And then, you know, the problem, which is, you know, just a classic problem in any sort of hierarchy, is that it's easier for the information to roll downhill than it is to roll uphill. When people start seeing things go wrong, why would you question the founder? He made all the right decisions. And that's, you know, that is what becomes culture. It's what becomes corporate culture. And it becomes this significant problem of, like, how do you debug that? And it's really hard to debug, because you have to go into organizations and have them have conversations with which they have trained themselves to not have. And often, you know, if you wait too long, the founder's no longer around and can't answer the questions anymore.
I actually this brings to mind like Dave Gray and his like work on company culture, and yep, how he talks about like that culture are the things that we talk about, and but it also like defines the things that we're not allowed to talk about.
That's right.
And it's also like culture creates focus, because there are things that we don't talk about. That's that, right, we've kind of solved them and we've kind of set them in a box that like these are like, this is how it works, but we also have a box that is kind of like that, it's, we're not allowed to go there anymore.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, Herbert Simon talks about this a lot, right? Humans are bounded. So we can only do so many things. No matter how big our organizations get, I mean, so, you know, you apply Brooks's law or any of these other kind of scaling laws, you can't think more by having more people. You really are bounded to a certain extent. You have to focus on something. And so culture is roughly the underground set of agreements that we have that allow us to focus on other things, often on conflict, frankly, the things that we want to have arguments about. And the result of that is, again, it just becomes very hard to talk about. You lose the skill, you lose the performative aspect of those types of discussions, and you just don't know how to do it anymore. So I think it's interesting for sure.
Yeah. I know that a lot of your thinking is influenced by systems thinking and complexity theory, and I kind of want to talk a little more about that.
Sure.
And I think it would be useful if we just start with a couple of definitions.
Sure.
So what is systems thinking?
So I actually teach a class on this at CMU at Carnegie Mellon.
Awesome.
And I still always feel like I don't quite have my head all the way around it, mostly because it's a big topic, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So systems thinking has to do with something to do with holism, right? With this idea of a whole. That has a lot of problems just there. And it only gets worse, really. But in general, systems thinking starts with general systems theory, which was an attempt to unify biology. So you get a bunch of biologists, and they're all studying these kind of fragmented ways of thinking about biological creatures. The question ends up being, well, none of this is actually explaining how a human works or how an animal works. It's all kind of explaining how the parts work. Then we start trying to figure out, okay, well, there must be some other way of thinking about this. And so they come up with what's called general systems theory. The general systems theory, proposed that there was a whole, and that the whole was greater than the sum of the parts, although that is often argued as well, the exact phrasing of that. It comes out of different pieces as well. So, like, you can see... you can see Aristotle talking about these ideas. You can see Gestalt theorists talking about these ideas. You get cybernetics as a spinoff. You get systems thinking as a spinoff. You get soft systems thinking as a spinoff. And all these people are just trying to kind of come up with this idea that is roughly what's the opposite of reductionism? What is the way that we can think of wholes? So system thinking, Akoff's version of it, might be a system is a set of parts that are all interrelated, and that the interrelations with those parts creates some sort of higher level phenomenon or higher level effect that can be called a whole.
Okay. And another train of an area of thinking is that I know you're very familiar with and use a lot is complexity theory. Mm-hmm. So how about like a brief definition of complexity theory?
So complexity theory is maybe even worse than systems theory. First of all, I would say that the two are distinctly interrelated. There's no way to separate them on some extent. Here's the first version of it that I would do is complexity is a natural occurring phenomena. It doesn't have anything to do with humans, right? It exists in the world. At least significant parts of complexity theory would be true whether or not there were human observers involved at all. Systems theory may be the attempt to model things based on our bounded cognition that allow us to comprehend those complex aspects of the world, right? So systems theory is distinctly observer-oriented. There's always an observer in a system. In system theory, whereas complexity theory doesn't rely on any sort of observer, I don't think. So that's one aspect of it to kind of differentiate them. Complexity, in general, is the study of the way that parts interrelate and the emergent phenomenon from those parts. So that emergent phenomenon could be a whole or it could be something else. There's different kind of schools of thought involved. But I would say complexity is the theory of how things don't turn out the way one might expect them to. And the fact that that is a natural part of the universe and that's something we cannot reduce using kind of normal rational thought.
Why have you been so interested in this stuff? There's a use for it. It's useful for you in some way, I hope. You're not just reading about it. So
complexity theory to me and systems theory, I think a systems theory is maybe one of the... Systems theory is one of the major kind of intellectual forces in the world that's unsung. It's like actually not recognized widely. But it is one of the most important ways of thinking about the universe that's out there right now. So, you know, for a very long time, kind of traditional reductionist thinking was the way to think about the world. And in traditional reductionist thinking, the world is completely chaotic. There's no meaning and everything's random. And you can see lots of things like Darwin, all these things kind of rise out of that way of thinking. Systems theory is a way of saying that that's not true. Complexity theory is a way of saying that's not true, that there is some sort of underlying organization to the universe, and that organization reflects itself through different permutations, right? So I think trying to figure out how to help people think in these two different modes, not just one or the other, but recognize the difference between the two, gives them skills and tools for thinking through different types of situations. What's complex to me may not be complex to you. What's simple to me may not be simple to you, vice versa. And therefore, maybe there's different skills and ways of thinking through problems that we could learn, that when we address ourselves to certain situations, we would say, I need to use this way of thinking right now for me in order to help this. And so I think that, to me, it's not a way of thinking differently. It's a way of expanding the tool set of thinking so that we can think better in different situations.
Okay, that's really good. So what would be the first thing, like if a listener wanted to kind of expand their tool set in thinking and wanted to get something out of complexity theory or systems thinking, do you have like a tip that like what would be a starting point?
Sure. So, you know, one of the really, really fun versions of this that I love is these guys did a study. I won't remember their names right now, but I can get that to you later. They did a study of people playing Tetris.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Tetris looks like a pretty simple game. The blocks fall down and you're trying to get them into the right slots and try to figure out. And they were trying to figure out how people do this. And the first way to think about it is pragmatic action, right? So they say, okay, you look at the block and you look at all the spaces and you try to figure out what orientation the block needs to be in. And you put that block in that space, right? So that's pragmatic action. So as the game goes faster and faster, it becomes very important to be very efficient, right? You don't want to make any excess movements because all the excess movements are wasted, right? So you want to do very pragmatic, direct action towards the goal. And then they watched, and this was true for lots and lots of players, and then they watched the best players in the world, and the best players in the world did this very weird thing. They spun the pieces very quickly around. And what they were doing was minimizing their cognitive load by actually making the shape in different... They didn't have to imagine the shape being in different places. The shape was in different places, as, you know, orientations. And so they could just compare directly. So it was not pragmatic action. It's what they call epistemic action. And so the basic version of this for learning is trying to figure out, am I trying to achieve something directly? Do I know concretely the goal that I'm trying to achieve? Or am I trying to learn something about the goal? Am I acting epistemically? And often this has to do with getting a feel for how much you understand the problem, how concretely you understand the problem you're trying to solve, how concretely you understand the solution you're trying to implement in relation to that, and whether or not which of the two skills you're trying to do. If you are trying to effectively basically make the bottle that you've been making for the last 20 years better, you know, Toyota production system, super lean, super efficient, yes, will work great. If you don't know how to make a bottle, you have a different problem on your hands. And that's just that really simple exercise of thinking through, do I really know what I want? How concretely do I know what I want? Should I be trying to think through this? Or should I be trying to produce it?
Thank you once again for listening. Feel free to share this episode with people you think might want to hear it. You can meet Jabe at the Lean Agile Scotland conference in October. I'm going to be there too. Get your ticket now and don't forget to use the promo code BOSSLEVEL. The second season of Boss Level is nearing its end. The next episode is going to be the last one in the season, and the third season will begin in August.
So if you're interested in sponsoring, you need to email me now at sami@bosslevelpodcast.com because the slots are running out. As promised, this episode will end with a song from the band that I sing in. If you can't stand death metal, then you might want to stop listening now. But if you're curious, stay tuned. If you like the song and want to see us live, the next chance is at the Tuska Open Air Metal Festival on the 2nd of July in Helsinki. The album is available on Spotify, iTunes, and others. This song is called The Lake. Enjoy.
Lost. rise beneath the smile, becoming undone.